Congratulations.
Thank you.
And good luck with the rest of your training.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you, Teresa. Yes, thank you. Okay, so I would like to welcome everyone to this final speaker series call of 2014. Today it's my pleasure to welcome Tammy Shankle. For the past 20 years, she has been the community field representative, I can spit it out, overseeing the puppy clubs of the Central Coast of California. Today we're all excited to hear all about the puppies, so take it away, Tammy.
All right, I'm excited to talk to you guys. I got some questions that you guys submitted, so I'll try to get to those, but wanted to just give you a quick overview about our puppy raising program the way it is now. I oversee about 130 puppies in my territory, and that's I govern about 17 different clubs, and I plan to see most puppies at least 4 or 5 times during their puppy raising period at a minimum. Part of what I do is evaluate the dogs on a regular basis so I can oversee what where they are in the process and add different protocols to hopefully make them more successful. The other thing I do is hold workshops for the raisers and also train the leaders who are volunteers for us. So that's kind of a quick overview. I also have raised about 20 puppies myself, so I came to this as a puppy raiser prior to becoming a CFR, is the short term for my title. So, most of you guys probably already know that the puppies are raised in clubs led by volunteer leaders, and they meet at least twice a month. That's what we require, but most of the big ones meet weekly. And then baby puppies are seen on a weekly basis, even if the club only meets twice a month. The leaders see them on a weekly basis until they're at least 5 months of age. That way they're off to a good start. Currently, our puppy raising program is undergoing a 5-year plan to kind of optimize the use of positive reinforcement. So we're using a lot more food in the program than we have in the past, and then we're getting great results. So every puppy at this point for the last, I'm really bad with numbers, but probably for the last 9 months have been utilizing food to teach loose leash walking. Starting when they're tiny babies, they also use food to introduce the gentle leader, and they do that quite young. They also are using food to reinforce calm behavior and also for focus around distractions, and all that starts right from day one when they go home. We have some new kind of tethering games we're playing with the puppies, and that when we're able to get food, and that's something that keeps us focused on the raiser. Early self-control. We're getting a major echo from you.
From me?
Yeah. Let me see.
Not sure.
It just started. And I'm not, okay. I'll try and hold one
out. Quit.
Okay. Let me know if that's going again.
Okay.
So anyway, we're using a lot of food. Historically, in the last 5 years, we were using food as a protocol. So when we noticed a puppy struggling with a problem, then we would intervene and use food rewards to see if we could overcome the problem. But in that process, we learned that the earlier intervention, the better, and actually starting out with food in their learning process was much more successful. So it's really exciting now to go to a puppy meeting and see 4-month-old puppies marching along on a loose leash, just paying attention and earning those little kibbles. We're not using a clicker with any of the puppies. We use a verbal marker, so we use the word nice, and it's used in the same way as a clicker. We just don't use that, so that's for the lack of a better term, an unpolluted sound to them when they come in for training.
You need to be careful, even in your conversations, not to use the word nice around your puppy, because they'll look.
What I tell the raisers is you should be able to use the word, like, you have a nice shirt.
Yeah.
But you shouldn't say you have a nice shirt. Most people don't do that anyway, but they're ever so opportunistic. So if they think they can get some kibble out of you, they're going to try, I think. The raisers have taken to this food work really quite well. We were concerned a little bit about the skill and if we'd get some downside, or, you know, if there's a downside to using food, but we haven't seen much of that at all. So it's going quite well. And the hope is to continue using food more in the program. So we're trialing right now in a couple what we call R-plus pilot clubs. We're trialing using food for sit, down, and stand for the foundation positions, and trying to do that as operant as possible. So that's in the works and for the future, I think.
Is that true? And with Fort Worth, the new Fort Worth Club, I'm actually a part of that, and I had heard that, that they were possibly going to use that as, you know, use us as a guinea pig. Still truly going on?
Well, each CFR, so there are 10 of us, so each CFR has been given the okay to be a pilot, to create a pilot club where we can have a group of raisers that know that we're trialing things and everything might change, so we don't frustrate the bigger raiser population, kind of keeping it small and messing around with some different techniques. So in my territory, I have two of them, two different pilot clubs, and so you may be one that she's looking at. You have Sandy, is that right?
We do.
Yeah. So she may be looking at that as a, to start with some baby puppies. Typically what that looks like is going to a group that she can meet with regularly and then a group that has baby puppies coming in, because these are all techniques we start as young as possible.
Yeah, we just got Fort Worth, just got the first steps.
Oh, great. So I hope you guys get to do that, because we're learning a lot.
We have, they said we were, so.
Oh, great. Yeah, it's been really, I've had two different R-plus clubs for about a year, actually over a year, and we've learned a lot, and we changed the techniques a dozen times at least. So I'm glad we're going through this step before we, put it out there to everybody. But it's been a great deal of fun, so I hope you get to be involved in that. It's quite fun. There was also a question about, you know, some of the what expectations or the goal behaviors for the puppies before they go in for training. So I wanted to talk about that a little bit. All throughout raising, the raisers are taught to focus on these goal behaviors we identified. So good house behavior is one key thing we count on the raisers to do. The expectation is that the puppies could be loose in with full access to the house for the minimum of 30 minutes. Actually, most of them shoot for like 2 hours, so, and with the raiser not at all present. So that's the goal behavior. Of course, puppies get to that level at a much different time, depending on, you know, what the environment looks like and how much self-control the puppy has. But that's the goal behavior, that they can be left alone for a minimum of 30 minutes without a sterile, clean environment. And so that happens very incrementally, because if you start too young with a puppy that's teething and has no self-control, and, you know, you're going to end up accidentally teaching puppies to be opportunistic and a bit sneaky, as a matter of fact. So we want that environment to, they start off on tie downs generally, or in an X-pin, or in using their crates and using a drag line, so that they have a lot of supervision, so they learn the parameters of what the expectation is the puppies do. We also try to minimize the interaction with other dogs in the household until they get older. So again, they have self-control and they don't build an overly strong relationship with another dog in the home versus a raiser, for instance. So we work really hard on that, hoping it'll minimize some of the dog distraction, which is one of the biggest issues we tend to have in public, is dog distraction. So the good house behavior would look like, I'm sure you guys know what that would look like, but it would basically be a dog that's calm and settled, not pestering for attention, not stealing things, so no destructive behavior, no counter surfing, and we want them to be quiet, so no vocalization. So it's all, you know, a work in progress. As, you know, as a baby puppy, they get excited easily, so the raisers just kind of keep adding freedom. So a deal breaker for a puppy before it goes into training, if they don't have the ability to stay alone, either comfortably because they're anxious or because they are destructive, then that's a reason to career change them before they come into training. We also have a puppy sitting process that we utilize. So a puppy raised in one type of household, maybe with children and other pets, would be puppy sat by a different sort of household, and to kind of proof out, because sometimes they'll act very, very different in a different environment. So we do that throughout puppy raising. They do organized puppy trades for like a couple days. So that's helpful in proving out the house behavior. The other thing that we want is a dog that's completely housebroken, of course, and actually also relieves only when given the cue to relieve, the do-your-business cue. And, of course, if the criteria we have for them before they come into training is that they can walk a brisk mile without having an accident, and that they've been accident-free for at least 2 months. So that's our criteria before they go back for training. If we don't reach that, then, again, their career changed prior to going into training. The problem we deal with relieving is, of course, we start with eight-week-old puppies, and their metabolism changes lots during that time, and their body fluctuates quite a bit in terms of their dependability. But they're usually pretty solid by 10 months of age. Much sooner they're housebroken, but, you know, solid on walks. So it's a bit of a challenge to, as they continue to have changes in their food intake and their metabolism, to get them on a regular relieving schedule. But that's our criteria before we send a puppy in for training. Our raisers are also asked to expose them to as many things as they can within the puppy's developmental ability to handle that kind of situation. So restaurants, public transportation, and if somebody sent a question about how often are the puppies, you know, on an airplane, and a lot of raisers don't have access to that, and we wouldn't want a very young puppy in that situation. And there's quite a large number of puppies that never get that exposure prior to training. It's just something that, especially with TSA these days, and the puppies don't have legal access, that it doesn't happen a lot. So that might be quite a novel thing when a puppy's actually going home with you guys. Is their might maybe their first exposure to airplane travel. So the puppy raisers try to incrementally take them out and socialize them in areas that they can handle. And one of the things that we're looking for, the CFRs are looking for, is a dog that's confident and doesn't have any significant fears, or if they're reacting, can we help them through that process and build confidence in an area, like when they're exposed to novel stimulus, like an elevator for the first time or open stairs. So it's done very, very gradually. And most of them do really, really good, but a dog that lacks confidence is going to be a reason for the dog to be career changed before it comes into training. The other thing is to keep in mind is that all the raisers are volunteers, so they're not professional dog trainers, and a lot of them, these are their first experience in raising guide dog puppies. We have a lot of people that raise many, many puppies in a row, but we also have a good number who, are first-time raisers, and so there's quite a big, huge variance in skill level of our raisers and their ability to read an animal. So we're trying to make sure we're educating them through that process. One of the reasons we might drop a dog, again, would be confidence issues, control, and their ability to be managed and without getting mouthy or silly or goofy. So that we're looking for willingness. The relieving issues, of course, is a big one that we try to catch before they come into training. And their level to focus, their ability to focus in public, so not being overly distracted by greeting people or seeing other dogs in public or animals in public. So that's something that's constantly ongoing. But again, the skill level of the raisers varies a lot. And so sometimes we're stuck with puppies that we don't know about a behavior if they don't let us know. So we try to evaluate them in a real-world experience at least 4 times before they come into training. That said, still gets by. So, you know, I know there was a question about some of the house behaviors you guys deal with. And hopefully it's proofed out before they get there and it's not a big issue. But I don't know how much of that you guys see in terms of, do you guys see a lot of relieving problems with the dogs that you have or house behavior issues?
It's definitely gotten better.
Oh, good.
Over the years.
That's good. We try to focus on it a lot, although, you know, again, it's one of those things where we are tasked to kind of figure out what's going on in areas we can't see. So we don't frequently go into a raiser's home, and so it's about them reporting to us what's happening so we can be proactive with it. So that's kind of a quick overview of the puppy raising program. I know that we deal with some of the issues that you guys deal with about working dogs in public, and that's part of the reason that we've switched to much more positive methods in training the puppies. Again, it's much funner to train them that way anyway, and they seem to respond much better, but it's made it a lot easier to work dogs in public with the use of food. So that's gone really well and actually helped in terms of public perception when we're working young puppies in public. Not sure if that was a question, if somebody had a question.
No, somebody had unmuted their phone.
Okay. So I don't know if you guys have questions. I'm happy to open it up to questions and kind of see if we can answer things you guys have been wondering about or talk about some of the particulars.
This is Michelle McGrew from Mountain View, and I have a comment and kind of a bit of a caution. My current guide, when I first got him, you know, the word okay is used as a release command,
mm-hmm.
and he is incredibly good at generalizing, and especially the first few months that I had him, I would give him a command to sit, and he would sit, and then he would hear me say okay in general conversation with a friend, and up he would bounce. And I had to, and it was really frustrating for me because my other dogs were much better at picking out which okay was for them and which wasn't. And my friend would just gently remind me that, well, you know, okay is the release command. And I go, yeah, I know, grumble, grumble, grumble. And so I would be a little concerned about using a word like nice that comes up in conversation very easily, that just beware that some dogs are very opportunistic and very clever, and they are more than happy, she said it, you know, and just to be aware of that.
We do look at that, and one of the things that we actively teach our raisers is that even a release command doesn't mean that they can be silly, goofy goons and go crazy, right? And that they, even when you praise them and say, good puppy dog, that they don't just get to go crazy. And also, again, you hit the nail on the head when you said they're opportunistic. So if they think they can trick you into, yep, I heard the word nice, without the inflection, because the raisers are taught to make it as a sound and not as much as a word good in common talk, you know, common speech. So, but again, a puppy, like even in my household with multiple dogs, if I say nice to one of my dogs, the other ones will come over ever hopeful.
She said the word.
So I will just, you know, ignore them because they're going to ask, like, can I have that? Can I have one for that? So I think that's
right
part
here.
Of the personality of the dog we have, right? So I think it's something that we try to train through, and we caution the raisers not to make it an excuse. Oh, I said nice, so I guess I better give them a food. You know, the dog should be a little bit more perceptive in the inflection.
Okay, that's good to know. Because, yeah, I mean, he wouldn't necessarily get super excited. He would bounce back up into a standing position and, you know,
yeah,
a little bit more mobile. It's like, no, I didn't mean for you to stand.
Right. So Michelle, what's your new dog thing? You were getting Garvey when I was getting Pollyann.
I still have George. I still have Garvey.
Oh my gosh, he's still working?
Yes, he is.
How? Good boy.
And now.
Yes, he is. Well, please scratch him under his neck. And I have a question.
Uh-huh.
Jeanette Dixon from Washington. Can you tell us about what the process is
to become a puppy raiser. I joined the puppy club in the Spencer Dot Drama in 2008, and it's for that. And if I need someone to speak all over. So can you tell us what the process is to start being a puppy raiser? What does someone have to do?
So basically, to be a puppy raiser, I hope you guys can hear me.
No,
we can't. Let's see. Let's wait for a second there. Okay, so to be a puppy raiser, the process is basically they have to be willing to commit the time and attend the meetings. They have to have a schedule that works with the current club. So typically the clubs meet weekly on a Tuesday. And so then also they have to come to three consecutive meetings prior to even filling out an application to make sure that they're serious. Once they have started coming to meetings and that's where they learn the methodology, then the leader will do a home visit, and that's the one-on-one time for a would-be raiser to have time with the leader in their own home. The leader will then meet the family animals and the rest of the family and make sure they understand what they're getting into, and it also gives us kind of an eye on what the household looks like and what the dynamics are there. And then we ask them to puppy sit for at least 5 days so that they really understand what they're getting into, because puppies are cute, it's easy to think, it's an easy thing to do, so we want them to understand how 24/7 this project really is. And then once we deem them ready, so we build skill, they handle puppies at the meetings, then they would be ready to raise. So very few people that want to do it cannot do it. I mean, a reason to eliminate a raiser or somebody who wants to raise would be possibly a dog or pet in the household that might teach a baby puppy a negative behavior, like a dog who is threatening up to people or suspicious of people. So we have that kind of criteria. Then we need a safe household and understanding and willingness to follow our rules. So it can be a little bit long process, and it varies by skill of the person applying. Does that answer?
I have a question. This is Charlotte Kirchner.
Mm-hmm.
And I currently, my third died about 2 years ago. And so I get to come back into all of this brand new. And things have changed.
The last time I was in town, it really isn't.
Okay. The last time I went for training was in 2003. But one of the things that I have been doing is a lot of walking myself and thinking about my environment in some new ways. I had been working, and I worked in towns that were satellite, little townships around the where I live now, and I didn't know my own hometown. It was sort of bizarre. My dogs knew these little towns better than they knew our home, other than our neighborhood. My neighborhood has lots of sidewalks and stuff like that. So I've been learning some new destinations, which I'm loving very much, even just doing it with cane travel. But trust me, I'm very tired of getting stuck in the tummy by a cane. And I'm very, 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 very excited about I'm scheduled for April. But here's my question, because the walks that I have been developing, one of which gets me to my... One gets me to the mall. Yeah, that's fun. And one gets me to a park. But each of those is pretty much the same route until the end. And it's about, round trip, 3.5 miles. So, young dog, how long a walk do they really like?
Well, you know, they should be able to do that quite easily. And so it's harder for...
Has that ground noise? It's *6 on your phone, and that'll mute.
We all need to do that, or just
whoever is beeping. Should be asking questions, but mostly the person on the bus.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, whoever it is.
Sounds like a truck.
Yeah, or a train to Buster or something.
Here we go.
Okay. And you can hear it. I fresh on it. And you can hear it.
Star
Star six.
Sorry about that.
That's okay.
Okay, longer walks are absolutely fine. They should be, you know, young dogs have lots of stamina, and that shouldn't be a problem. And actually, it should be good for them. You want to, you know, running is something we don't allow our raisers to do with their puppies, like jogging, just because their joints are finished growing and pounding on the cement. But we actually recommend if they take long walks, especially the older dogs, so we can, you know, just have that muscle, that aerobic kind of piece. So I wouldn't be concerned about that at all.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
I have a question. This is Julie Johnson from Texas. I just recently got my dog 2 months ago with all the new training and everything. He's my fifth dog, so I've seen everything change over the years. Mm-hmm. I've always wondered, number one, I heard there was a club now in Dallas, Texas, that somebody was speaking earlier that was from Dallas. I would love to attend one of your meetings. But the other question I had, what if somebody gets so attached to their dog and they just decide I can't give them back to the school? What do you do in a situation like that? I know it would be really hard to give the dogs back after you've...
That's a good question, and you know, a lot of times in public, as puppy raisers, we'll meet people that will say, "Oh, we're glad that you're raising puppies, but we could never do it. We could never give the dog back." And of course, that always feels like the puppy raiser that we don't love them as much as somebody else would. I think they go into it knowing what they're doing, and the leaders and the club dynamics are such to keep reminding them, you know, that that's part of the process. It's not an easy process. Having raised 20 dogs, I will tell you, I cried as hard as I drove my puppy to San Rafael the last time as I did the very first time. And with my first puppy, I have to say, I even toyed with the idea of, well, if I cut off his tail, they wouldn't want him, or if I moved to Canada, they couldn't find me. You know, we do it with tears, and it doesn't happen very often that we have a runner, you know, somebody who is not going to turn it in. But there is a grief process with that, and the clubs build real strong support for the raisers, because that's a known ending for this project, and they count a lot on getting updates on the dogs in training, and the graduations mean a lot to them, and so I think that helps. But we don't really have, in the 20 years I've been a CFR, I've never had anybody not turn a dog in. I've had people, we need to hold their hand through that process, but that puppy sitting I talked about earlier helps them realize that this is not their dog, that we can choose when the dog goes somewhere else, you know, for a little while. So it's part of the project that they know they're getting into that. But it is the hardest part, I think, is that saying goodbye, because you can't explain to the dog what's happening and why you're dropping them off or putting them on the puppy truck. And sometimes it helps to get a baby puppy in return, but not so much in my mind.
I have a question.
Huh?
I have a question. This is Marilyn. My previous dog, who went back about 3 months ago because he was so strong and he had other things, I found out when I was in class, and even later on, especially, and I asked this puppy raiser, they were never able to get under control. He was 18 months old, and even after that, he would bite. He was a nipper like a puppy, and I mentioned it before he went back to them about it, and they go, "Oh, yeah, we were never able to get his teeth under control, mouth." And I would have bruises. And he jumped all over me. And then the other thing is, I've never known a dog, I guess, he's my fourth, and he was terrified of flying. I almost didn't leave Portland Airport, so I couldn't even hand my ticket over. And then he tried to jump over the person. He was just shaking like crazy. And then we had to, but anyway, and when I mentioned it one time, because they had a houseboat outside of Lake Tahoe, and they were telling me, because I had a convention in Reno, you couldn't travel after that unless you sedated him. But anyway, they told me that when he was a puppy, he was so scared that they had a houseboat, they would have to carry him on and off. He did not like surfaces. My question is, do they ever work on, like, if they have any area that they can put him on a little robot, anything that really gets him walking or any movement? I mean, this dog, I could not travel. The only thing he liked was a train.
Right. hold evaluations for the puppies, and we try to do them, again, at least four times during their puppy raising period.
Mm-hmm.
One of the places that I do my evaluations is at Ventura Harbor, for instance. So we walk down the dock, there are lots of dogs there, there's a movement of the dog, so we try to simulate that. For the most part, we try to proof that out, but not everybody has access to an airplane. Most probably don't, and most don't end up going on boats, I would guess. But usually that stuff shows up on another kind of surface. So if you put them on a swinging bridge, for instance, or like they have in kids' playgrounds,
right,
that kind of thing. Now with a baby puppy, a lot of times we think we've gotten rid of a problem and it'll resurface later. We can get them over it successfully, see them repeatedly do something like go over a moving bridge and they're fine, and then you add the responsibility of formal guide work, and there can be a drop in that confidence. So it's about discovering that stuff and getting the accurate reporting from the raisers.
Mm-hmm.
Not suggesting they would withhold it, but sometimes having novice people, they don't know what's important to tell us. So we try hard to ask the right questions and feed the dogs in a variety.
And then I just have one other suggestion. I don't know whether you do this, but I'm a volunteer at the hospital. And another reason we almost went back about 2 years ago was because there was a volunteer. Do you work along people that are in wheelchairs and walkers? Because as soon as he would see this guy, in a wheelchair, small guy, in a wheelchair, one of the other volunteers, he would jump on him. In fact, he did it once in the cafeteria as we were checking out.
Sounds like he didn't have a ton of self-control. I mean, he sounds pretty, unusual in my experience. In terms of,
and then he even jumped up on a counter.
Yeah, sounds like he has, no self-control, even with the mouthiness and that kind of thing. And he may be a dog that was in the raiser home, sort of what we would call handler dependent, where he won't test that person, but he might test another one. So with a different kind of handler, a new behavior comes up. One of the things that we try to do when we evaluate a dog is to actually handle the dog ourselves. But whether or not that shows this little, shows during that time, we try to make that happen. But
I just have one other comment, and then I'll let you know. The other thing, when we were in class, he laid on top of my chest on a beanbag and would not get up.
Oh, my. Yeah, sounds like he sort of slipped through the cracks on that one.
Yeah, I had to crawl underneath to get under him.
Yeah.
And then I looked down, he was still there.
Yeah, and it's really hard. Somebody asked a question in the ones that were sent in about softer dogs. And one of the things that we've tried to do, I'm not from the breeding department, but, having seen 20 years worth of puppies, trying to breed a dog that is still very, very confident and self-confident, yet soft enough that they're not going to push those kind of buttons, and see what they can get away with. So it's a very difficult balance to get. And we're getting there. I think we do have softer dogs. And what that really means is a dog that's hospitable and willing and, in my mind, not sneaky. So a dog that isn't going to take advantage of a handler and that doesn't require excessive handling, to be honest. So, part of that kind of dog you're describing is, probably for them, honestly, this confidence from their point. A lot of times that behavior is paired with a very confident dog.
Am I on mute? No, you're not.
No.
No, I wanted to be on mute. So this is Deborah Kendrick, and I just unmuted myself in order to put in a plea that people press star 6. There's so much noise in the background in people's environments. It's incredibly rude.
Am I on mute?
Having said, we can hear you. And so having said that, I'm going to go back on mute. But,
can you hear me? Am I on mute?
You are not.
You
are not on mute.
I'm not.
No. Press star 6.
This is Charlotte Perker, and I have a question again about, what would be the, obviously you guys are asking questions of puppy raisers all along the way. But then we do get this, and I'm assuming this still happens, we get this chance to kind of interact and learn a little bit about the dog's history. And I know that's really important, some of the things that I learned about my last guide dog. kind of pointed towards some of the issues that she happened to have. You talk about a softer dog, but a softer dog, I would think, would also be a dog that, without the right level of support, can slip into whatever their particular anxiety issue is. And as somebody who's coming back at this, and I'm wanting to be as smart and capable and supportive of my next guide dog as I possibly can be. In other words, I want to learn more. I ain't perfect yet. I think my last guide dog had some anxiety issues, some pretty major anxiety issues. Now, she was, I felt like, an incredibly intelligent guide. But those anxiety issues, particularly over her lifetime as she got older, began to worsen. And I think that can happen with, I mean, I learned from talking with my regional trainer that that can happen, that some of those anxiety, like fireworks and thunderstorms became really, really problematic for her later in life. But anyway, what are the smart questions to ask when you have this chance to kind of interview the puppy raiser? What are the smart two or three questions to get them thinking about together with you about this dog that has now had multiple transfers in its poor young life?
So you're asking about questions for you to ask the raiser?
The puppy raiser. And not that it hasn't been happened already with screening, right, and, you know, with those kinds of questions, but it's really also helping the new partnership, helping that person to be aware what to watch for. What were the things? Like I had learned that she had actually had two different puppy raisers. She fell into a category of a dog that I think the first puppy raiser, now this is anecdotal, I have no way to confirm this, but the first puppy raisers were, from what I understood, were almost heading her towards failure. And you talked a little bit about that.
Mm-hmm.
And they were also apparently underfeeding her. Now, why they would do that, I don't know. But when she came back to the school before she got transferred to another puppy raiser, they had been feeding her like 2 cups a day, and since she was still a very young dog, at least at that time, she needed way more than that. Well, for the rest of her life, she had food issues.
Hmm.
Now, again, it's all anecdotal, so I didn't really know how to confirm the first, you know, the teenage girl that was telling you the stories about her from her first puppy raiser.
Right.
So I didn't have a way to confirm any of that, so I don't know.
Good question. So I would say, let me start with the transfer piece. So some puppies are started in what we call starter homes, so they like the part of a puppy until 4 or 5 months of age, and then they
mm-hmm.
transfer them to people that need to take a dog to work. Other thing that happens sometimes is someone or the dog is not being successful. So we look at both pieces, right? So if the raiser is not being successful with their training of the dog, or the puppy is not being successful in that environment and needs a different kind of support, then we intervene and we'll move the dog. We try to make it collaborative, and the raiser has some control over that. But, you know, basically we look at the dog and its ability to stay viable during that developmental process. So there's a lot of reasons dogs are transferred. And sometimes we don't share that with the second raiser so that they don't have
mm-hmm.
preconceived notions about the puppy, so that they don't come to the wrong conclusion about why something's happening, and to kind of uphold the confidentiality piece. More and more with social media, they end up knowing each other, and we share more and more. But so that may be why, and I'm not sure what the first raiser or the second raiser knew about the first raiser, so that may or may not have been, like you said, it was probably anecdotal.
And your
question about what to ask, I'll tell you some of the things I ask on my evals with people. I sit down and talk to them for 15 minutes, and then we go for a 30-minute walk. But some of the things I ask them, what is the puppy's strongest behavior in their mind, and what is the weakest behavior? So balancing both so they don't feel like they're telling on the dog, in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
That, we hope, is disclosed before you end up with the dog, right, so that it wouldn't be a surprise to us or to guide dogs prior to you getting the dog. But that's a good thing to ask. I think finding out what the daily routine was, which is part of what we get with the fun things about the puppy, right? We get an idea of what kind of environment they were raised in.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, how much was the puppy alone, for instance, or how much, you know, what was the puppy's day like? Did it go to work every day? That kind of thing, I think, is important to ask. You know, but I think asking that, what's the strongest point and what's the weakest point of the dog, is fair to ask.
Right.
So that's what I would suggest. Again, when you look at a puppy raiser, we have a hugely dedicated, devoted group of raisers, but they vary a lot in their ability to correctly assess a dog. So they may think they're telling you what they are seeing, but whether that's an educated assessment, you know, it is up for grabs. So part of what we do, the CFRs write up an infra-training report, trying to balance that so that the training staff has a picture of what the raiser was like, what their skill level was like, and their ability to go out, like they do monthly reports. So we part of what we're tasked with is we know the raisers pretty well, so we have an idea of, you know, how they're communicating and what they may or may not be reading about the dog. So I think getting an overall, we try to get an overall view of who the dog is before they come in for training. But, again, asking that question about both strengths and weaknesses is a good thing, I think.
Uh-huh.
And we'll probably give you the most information.
I have a question. This is Nick.
Uh-huh.
Is it okay?
Yep. Hey, Nick.
Okay, a question and maybe a concern. I got my first guide dog in 2004. She worked till she was 10 and a half, just retired her this year. And the training back then was on love and praise. Now everything is food, the food rewards. Are we going to look at a problem of dogs being obese because of all these food rewards?
Well, good question. So the raisers, now we do have you know, a large number of Labradors who think through their brains and through their stomachs a lot. They love food. But we also use secondary reinforcement, so the raisers are pairing the food with the praise, so we haven't had a problem with that. But we ask raisers, all the food rewards come out of the dog's daily portion. So basically, if they're getting 3 cups a day, 1 cup goes in the bait bag, and the others are given at meals, and the rest of what isn't used through the day is thrown back in that last meal of the day. So it shouldn't, but we were worried about that, and it took a bit of education. So, but we're not seeing that now, but we have to kind of stay on top of it, especially as food use gets more and more liberal. But it's supposed to be coming out of their daily ration, and they're just using kibble for the majority of the dogs. Occasionally we'll have a dog that has a bigger problem we're working with or has a lower food drive, and we'll use a higher value food, so something more palatable like a liver treat or something, and then we have to kind of mess around with their diet a bit so that they don't gain weight.
Okay. And I have just one other comment.
Uh-huh.
I want... You can pass along to everybody you know, and I just want to thank every puppy raiser for all their hard work and dedication that gives us these guide dogs.
Amen.
I would
amen.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's a good. Thank you for that comment, because it is really important to the raisers. They know what you know. They know where the puppy is going, and they feel good. Only they know what great homes you're going to give them and what service the dogs will do. But I think we need to keep telling them that, because it's a big, long project, and it's a lot of cleaning up of pee and poop and, you know, fixing that kind of thing and waking up in the middle of the night in the beginning, and then it's an awful lot of giving up. You know, they give that puppy back, and that's a tough one. So
my dog, this is the 15th dog she's trained.
Wow.
From the Tucson, Arizona.
Hi, this is Deborah, and I'm grateful to whoever muted. Thank you so much. And I have a kind of comment / question. I am working with actually my 6th dog from Guide Dogs for the Blind now, and every single one of them has been fabulous. But one little quirky thing that none of them did until this one that has caused great amusement among my family and friends, and I bet everybody here is going to recognize this, that I would say, come, and they would come, but they would stand, you know, I'm totally blind, so if I don't touch you, you aren't there, and they would come within my hand, you know, and my kids would say, Mom, she's right there, she's right in front of you, or she's right beside you, but I couldn't, you know, and my current dog, God bless her, Razor, I guess, taught her, because she comes and puts her nose in my hand, and it is just so great.
Yep. Debbie, I'm going to correct you. Hobie's a boy.
You just called her a he, him, a her. I have, this is Deborah Kendrick. I have four.
Oh, I'm sorry. You said it like Debbie was silly. I'm sorry.
Oh, that's all right. Yeah.
Well, no, you're totally fine. Fine. Hello.
Hi.
Why are you a little bit?
Anyway,
I had one. I have a question.
Huh?
And this is one that I like to see on the Puppy Raiser reports. You talked about dogs having a fear in the early months, and it sometimes it can come out later.
Mm-hmm.
Why isn't that told to us as owners?
Well, we look, I'm not sure exactly what access you guys have to the reports, but a lot of it is, you know, usually if it comes back, for the most part, it usually is resolved, and we work hard to do that. But sometimes you look back and you go, wow, it came back when you add responsibility. That isn't something it's something we count on not happening, of course, but it does happen to us every once in a while, and you can kind of look back. Sometimes it happens if it was even never in the history. And so it would be great if it was all more predictable, but unfortunately, it's not. But sometimes we'll look at a puppy. It's common for a baby puppy, for instance, to have some concerns on stairs, to be a little bit uneasy the first time it's in an elevator or whatever.
I was more talking about when you were talking about suspension bridge or boats or things like that, firecrackers, you know, fireworks, those kind of things. I'm talking more the major kind of things. Because I had one dog, it came out again later in its adult years.
Right.
Not, it outgrew it, but it came back to later. And I think if I'd known, I could maybe help some sooner.
Yeah.
When the early signs came back.
Yeah, and although sometimes it gets worse as they get older, and sometimes you can fix it and sometimes you can't. So let me back up a stick first and answer the first question about the cum fan.
Thank you.
The raisers have been taught for, I would say, easily 5 years now. Again, I'm not a first person. To have the puppies come in and actually bump into them and put their head between their legs, the raiser's legs, so that they
We're getting background noise again, so whoever has that, if you can hit *6, that would be great.
And the raiser is taught to then reach for the collar so that the dog doesn't back away in a keep-away thing, and that they make this contact. They actually feed the dog a reward from between their legs.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
And now, that's really nice to hear, Tammy.
Well,
and I shared that deliberately because I thought maybe it's something that you can repeat to reinforce.
I will definitely do that, because it's one of the things we talk about. It seems a little weird for a puppy raiser when they're first learning that, okay, we need you to reach around behind your legs and feed them through so we get that head bumping.
Uh-huh.
We know that behavior will erode a bit as the puppy and the raiser get them more lax in what they're doing, so we start with a pretty deep head bumping into their legs. So hopefully that is seen in most of the dogs. And then to answer the second question that just kind of came up about, you know, novel things that happen to a puppy young, a lot is kind of within the norm. But when you mention thunderstorms and that kind of thing, our raisers are not supposed to be taking puppies to fireworks or to football games or places where they have fireworks or that kind of thing. So some of them don't have that exposure, and that's done on purpose so they don't have a negative response until they're old enough and have enough of a confidence built up in general that hopefully that won't impact them as much.
I didn't even have to take my dog out of the house when there was firecrackers. He would just literally shake to death.
Oh, poor boy.
It's one of those bad things. Saying if there was an issue early on in that kind of area, those, especially if they've even broken it in the first year, sometimes those, you know, it was 3 years after I got them. Before the first time it happened.
It may be that they were raised in an area where there weren't thunderstorms.
And that's very true. We have a lot of raisers we have raisers that when it rains, they run out in California to have their dog's experience walking in the rain.
Exactly.
I'll hear over and over again, my dog was fine in the thunderstorm. So, you know, pretty dedicated that way, but you're very, very right when you say they may not even ever have been exposed
always thinks it was relevant, so, you know, it's kind of come up again and again, they're going to test for it in training, whether it shows up or not. So a dog continues to grow, right, in their experiences throughout their whole lifetime. So you can have a dog that something can start at 5 years of age even, you know, that was never seen before, or it was seen maybe a little bit resolved, but that doesn't mean that's why it came back. So it's a very complex piece. And
I can give you an example of something that I was told about. One of my dogs, her puppy raiser told me that when they had to work really hard with her because she was really scared when it had been raining and the cars went by and it went swoosh, that scared her really badly.
Whoa.
They worked really hard with her and they got her to the point where that didn't scare her anymore. But they did tell me about that, and I was glad that they told me, because that way I knew that if she ever did get startled by that, I would have an idea of, you know, that had been an issue, and I could, you know, I could work with her to, you know, give her extra praise and extra
right.
encouragement.
Yeah, huge.
I don't think it was an issue for her so much later in life, you know, as I worked with her. But it was good to know, just to know that, you know, to be aware of that that had been an issue. And I know one of my other dogs, he had actually gotten lost. The first puppy raiser that she had been placed
wow.
with didn't follow the rules about keeping her in a yard, and she got lost for like a month.
Oh my gosh.
And so the puppy raiser that got her after that had to do a lot of work with her, but because we think she made it as a guide dog because she really wanted to please people, but that was actually good to know about, because we did see certain remnants of certain, if there were times where she would just get a little extra insecure or was extra interested in certain foods, and a lot, you know, those little quirky, certain quirky behaviors we looked at and went, you know, I think that goes back to the time when she was lost. It
right.
didn't mean we let her get to the food, and we still worked with her, and no, leave that alone, but it was good to know where that was coming from, so when she did get more insecure, because most of the time she was very confident and worked really well, but it was good to know that, oh, this is a little bit of that extra insecurity that's trying to sneak in, to know that
right.
I should be, you know, extra patient with her and really work with her. And so I was glad that they had let me know about that.
We do. The CFRs read all the Thumpty reports, and then we make and look at all our evals before a dog goes in for training, and we kind of collect all that information and share any threads we've seen throughout that. So if a dog had a serious issue early on, because a lot of it's puppy, right? So we have to be able to tell what's puppy and what are they maturing out of. And then that's shared with the training department so they can proof it out to see. And, you know, so it hopefully that information can be useful, but you also don't want to have a, it's always lovely to explain behavior, but sometimes we can't, and sometimes, you know, we're guessing when we're guessing where it came from. A dog that's been lost for a month, I did hear about a puppy that was missing for a while.
That was
maybe
back in the 1990s, early.
Right.
You know, end of the 80s, early 90s.
Yeah.
I got her in 1990, so it must have been in late 80s when she had gotten lost.
But sometimes we try to pick out the pertinent information so it's there as a piece of a thread of this may be who the dog is, this may be who the dog was, right?
Right.
And is
right.
it going to resurface and try to pick that out from what is just puppy behavior or puppy experience. So that's kind of the art of it, really, is trying to figure that out.
That must be quite a challenge.
It's a challenge, but it is
well,
part of it, you know, so, yeah.
This is Charlotte Kirstner, and this might be a good segue to
recommending some good reads on dog cognition, because that's one thing that also seems to have shifted in the last 10 to 15 years, and it's really shifted away from the old dogs are just wolves in dog clothing to, no, dogs are their own evolutionary path, and that they are very distinct from the wolf population in that they, we used to talk about alpha dogs, and you got to be the alpha dog, right. Blah, blah, blah. Well, that's kind of gone by the wayside, which to me sort of makes sense in connection with the food as being the primary way of interacting, and I guess, you know, maybe we don't like it, but it's this reward system, but it's creating this bond and this love, but that fits more with this evolutionary story, I think. I mean, I'm maybe making a leap here, but it fits with this evolutionary story of what's called self-domestication, that dogs have actually very intelligently figured out that human orientation is where their natural giftedness is, and that, anyway, I don't know how that fits with anything, but other than, what are the good reads? I've read this one that was called The Inner Life of Dogs by, I forget what her name is, Alexandra somebody or other, but she's, I think she's an animal behaviorologist, and she's written a book on it, I've read two or three different ones, but I don't know whether you've got some that maybe you recommend that are helpful with what current, because really some of this cognition stuff with dogs is new.
It is new, and it's so welcome. I mean, because it's one of those things that's like it makes so much more sense, and it's really, really interesting. And there are some good reads out there. I'm trying to think, I can email you some more as they come up in my brain if you'd like. You can email me, and I'll send you some more. But there's a couple good ones out, like How to Speak Dog, that's a good one, and Dog Sense. Some of these are quite new, those might be a couple, but maybe I can come up with a list and I can send them and you guys can forward them on to everybody if you'd like. Try to draw them out of the top of my brain. But you're right, the perception has really, really changed. It's nice to have this realistic look at them instead of thinking about it only as alpha kind of thing, just like you mentioned. So I'll put together a reading list if you guys would like. A lot of what I have is about baby puppies, but I also have some really good ones that I've read. So,
Tammy, I don't know if you're on mute or not, but I have a question. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about play and how, you know, what the parameters are with regard to the things that puppy raisers can and can't do or, you know, are encouraged to do.
Oh, good question. So one of the things that we look at is the end product, right? So they are not allowed to play with balls because we don't want to open up that gene of them, you know, running after tennis balls. So they don't play with retrieving kinds of games just because of the breed that we use. We do a lot of tug with them, and that's a bonding thing as well and something that we know that you guys utilize as well. So that's a game that's played. They play, they don't encourage a lot of play with other dogs, mainly because we need them to be focused on people and not build a strong desire to, an overly large desire to play with dogs. We
hide-and-seek.
Hide-and-seek we play a lot. We do the go-to-bed, which is kind of a game, and the dogs really like that. I mean, it's also a behavior that we teach, but it starts as kind of a game, and we do some mental games like that. Hide-and-seek's a great one. Play games of finding different toys, so there's hide-and-seek for people, there's hide-and-seek for toys. So that's what we also focus a lot, again, on what not to play, and that's mainly around frisbees and balls and chasing people, like running and keep away, because a lot of kids who are raising love it when a dog chases them, and that's not very useful for us.
No.
So teaching the dog to be in a big area and come when it's called, and they get a food reward, so they're running around, they are called off of something, and they zoom in and get a reward, so they have these lovely recalls that that happen. So those are some of the most important games they play.
Do you talk about the philosophy of play? I have had, not so much anymore because I've had her for 3 years and we've
kind of worked some of it out. But my current guide, when I first got her, there was some concern even when I was in training, because I would throw something and she would run to me and literally, well, she would jump on me, which was a problem in itself, but continued, you know, to play so hard that when I play with her to this day, I stand against something so that she can't knock me over.
Right.
And I'm not like feeble, but
yeah, but you're not a big girl either.
That's right. You know, if you don't see a dog coming, you know, you really can be knocked off your feet. So,
but as a breed, the retrievers tend to be a very physical dog. They like contact, and so one of the things that we talk to raisers about is to not encourage that. But they like, not necessarily body slamming is a bit too strong, but they get a reward out of contact. And so you get some young dogs that tend to be like touch football kind of guys, you know, you push them, they push back, and that's something we ask raisers not to do. Unfortunately, it's also rewarding for some people, and so we hope that they...
Big teenage boys.
Yeah, and so it's like, no, we can't do that. There's a lot of, we can't do that. You know, we try to make positive things for the raisers to be able to do with the puppies, but contact sports is not a good one, for just the reasons that you say, and, you know... It's a rude dog behavior as well, although different kinds of dogs play differently. But in the dog world, slamming something is pretty rude. So,
well, and in my instance, the raiser was very kind and apologetic. She confessed to me when I told her about it that she had done it. She said, I thought it was so adorable when she jumped on me. Mm-hmm. And
it's hard because you have to remember that, you know, and my perception, it's a little, maybe not the most correct one, but, you know, I think of people as animals too, so they are rewarded easily in their training process with some things that the dogs do, and so we have to look at why is the raiser doing it, and do they recognize that they're doing it, and that they're getting something that may not be useful out of it, you know, in the big picture, so we have to kind of identify that, and keep them on task with, okay, this is the outcome we need, and this is what that might cause. And so there's a bit of education with that all through puppy raising, is to understand why we need a behavior from a dog or don't need a behavior from a dog.
And I don't bring it up to complain about it. I mean, you know, it's worked out. It's okay now. But I think, you know, from your perspective, probably the more stories that you hear from grads, the more able you are to illustrate what you're trying to teach the raiser.
Absolutely. And we actually, it's always wonderful if a grad comes to a puppy meeting and explains some of it to the raisers. I mean, it's always very much enjoyed by the puppy raising population. And to get that insight for them into why we're doing what we're doing in a big way from the standpoint of, oh, yeah, I see that you can't see where the dog is or reach the dog and things they may not think on a daily basis. So even though that's part of their education, it is always focused on.
Well, the handler made me a better handler to go to a puppy meeting, because you have to follow the rules in front of those rangers, you know, and also to the person who was asking about the food protocols and things like that, you know, you may see the ranger do that and you see the result of what they get, because they pick up on things so much faster now than they used to.
And with a level of joy that, I mean,
they want to do it.
Oh, and they just, you see dogs now that when I watch them working on campus, they're just happy, happy, happy dogs. And when I go to puppy meetings, too, maybe puppies just marching along with their tails wagging, going,
their tails are up all the time.
And it doesn't diminish from their love or devotion to the raiser. I think it just elevates it. But I don't think it takes anything away, and a lot of raisers were afraid of that in the beginning when we introduced food, that, oh, they're only doing it for this, seems like a lesser reason. And that's where that philosophy comes in about how animals and, you know, people too learn. So it's important to look at that. It's not a replacement for the raiser or the grad in terms of how they are valued. It's just about how they learn, and it's so it's not something to be afraid of.
Hey, Tammy.
I have a warm and fuzzy question for you.
We got to wrap. We need to wrap up, Deborah. So
you said you've raised 20 puppies.
Mm-hmm.
So I wonder three things. How many graduated? Who was your first? Your parent.
You're good. Okay, my first puppy was Khan, and he worked for, he was placed with a gentleman in Southern California, and he worked at least 10 or 11 years. So I had quite a few make it, which was exciting, and some of that is luck, because I didn't have a lot of dogs that were dropped for medical reasons, and sometimes raisers have no control over that. So I haven't raised recently, mainly because of the kind of job I do and the travel, and it just isn't consistent with me being home to housebreak a puppy. But I have a career change that I live with, and she helps me with the Canine Buddies and comes to meetings sometimes. So, you know, I probably way more than half made it. Also, I tend to remember the dogs in my territory way too long. I don't remember things like my husband's birthday, but I do remember most of the territory for a long time. So I was listening carefully when you guys were saying your dogs' names, because I tend to remember the ones that were raised in my territory.
Okay, can I ask you a question?
I'm in Central California coast, so the closest I can, like, by near Monterey County is where I live. So my territory goes from Sonoma, Santa Rosa area, which is a little bit north of the campus, all the way down to Ventura, which is close to Southern California, and then a lot of the East Bay. So pretty big territory.
So you didn't do Napa, okay.
I do Sonoma now, but I don't do Napa. So.
Well, no, the puppy was raised many years ago in Napa. That's why I was asking.
Oh, yeah.
One of the really cool commands that my current guide is Garvey, and his puppy raiser, he was taught the word gently. He can be a little chompy and sort of forgetful of his own teeth strength, but he taught him the word gently. And so when I first walked into the room with him and I started playing with him, he went, chomp. And I thought, oh, no, he plays rough, because I've had a dog that played rough before. But I said, no, gently. And he surprised the heck out of me, because suddenly then he was very gentle. And I thought that was so cool. And when I mentioned it to his puppy raiser, she sounded so apologetic. She said, oh, I know that's not a standard command, but I taught him. And I said, no, thank you.
And I'll tell you why it's not a standard command is the ideal, the goal. I mean, it's not bad that they did it, but the goal would be that they're always gentle and that they look at a human being as the word gentle, right? Oh, when I interact with people, it's gently.
I use the word gentle with mine, and also Michelle and I were in class together in 2006, and I actually stole one of your commands that I still use, that she actually used with Garvey, and that is, stick up your nose.
That's a good one.
I've used it with all my dogs.
I still use it. Standard for Labradors.
Yeah. Hey, everyone.
I like the one my puppy raised.
And I've used it with every dog since. You know what? And then they go use their mouth. It's no play nip. And they learn. My hand moves. As soon as they go from my hand in the wrong way, it moved again with that word. Within usually two or three times, it was done.
Yeah.
We're probably about to get cut off, but the person who was asking about Texas Puppy Club, stay on the line afterwards, and I can give you information because I'm in Texas.
Hey, guys, it's Teresa. Can you guys hear me?
Yes.
Okay, guys. Awesome. Well, I want to, it is time to wrap up. I want to really thank Tammy for all of her wisdom today, and also just to to echo, I believe it was Nick that said, how much we love and appreciate our puppy raisers. I mean, none of this is at all possible. There's no way that this could happen without our puppy raisers. So please send our love back to the raisers. And I hope all of you have happy holidays. If you send me a list of books, I can post that list with the speaker series recording when it comes, when we have it up. All right?
Yeah, that's perfect.
All right, happy holidays, everyone.